Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to AMI Radio. I'm your host, Charles Green. Today we'll be speaking with author Anthony Caswell to discuss his book, The Social Gene. Mr. Caswell, do we have you on the line?
Yes.
How are you today?
Yes. Fine.
Wonderful to have you on the show. So I was wondering if you could begin by telling our listeners a little bit about your book and the project of it.
So you want me to talk about it? Or you will?
That would be wonderful. I would love to hear you explain it to our audience and get them excited about this wonderful work.
Okay, so the book is called The Social Gene, and it is a science book. But it is one that can be understood both by laymen and experts. It does not require any specialized knowledge to understand it. And it simply addresses the question as to how humans or animals relate with each other, how they cooperate, how they form groups, and how they offer services to each other. The topic is a contentious one, because according to animal theorists, supposedly, animals form associations with each other that are completely different from those experienced by humans. The bonds of friendship are recognized by sociologists to be strong among humans, while unaccountably, evolutionary biologists have accepted a completely different interpretation about animal behavior. Namely, that individuals are, to use the phrase of Richard Dawkins, ruthlessly selfish. That's from the Selfish Gene, his book. In this hypothesis, the absolute determination of individual interactions is that they preserve their own genes. Now, they do so, of course, by reproduction. But they may also preserve their own genes by offering special benefits to collateral relatives, such as uncles or nieces or even cousins. And those are the only cooperative interactions that animals undertake. That's the hypothesis. But there is nothing in classical evolution theory that would confine animals to this austere interpretation, and nothing in the observations of animal behavior that supports this conclusion. Yet it has become, for over half a century, it has become a dogma which seems to have been lodged in the minds of all participants in experimental studies. And it continues, I may say, a long tradition among theorists to relegate animals to an inferior status compared with us, for which there is no justification. So now let me give some examples of ways in which animals or animal associations are much more general than those implied in kin selection. One of these is in herd size. Herd size may vary considerably. Small herds of about, say, 10 individuals, such as those formed by deer and mustangs and goats and those kind of animals, small sizes may indeed be closely related. But that's scarcely surprising in view of the fact that infants are born into the herd. But what about large herds? The wildebeest of the African savanna, the caribou of the Canadian tundra, the huge colonies of emperor and king penguins in the vicinity of Antarctica. There is no way, no possible way that those can be closely related. And yet they form these sometimes extremely strong associations. Let me give another example. Adoption of orphaned infants or juveniles. Humans do that. So do many animals. It's not common, but it's not uncommon. Among the animals which do perform this service are chimpanzees, macaque monkeys, baboons, spotted hyena, grizzly bears, red squirrels. So, and some of those cases, the animals are closely related, the adoptor and the adoptee. But in other cases, they're not. An interesting example is the chimpanzee, in which males sometimes offer these benefits to juveniles, even though in chimpanzee society, the males don't really pay much attention to the infants. And yet those take place among unrelated species. So the question is, if that's not the case, if kin selection is not the mechanism, then what is? Well, we know a fair amount of this from our analysis of human interactions, and there's no reason why animal interactions should be any different. The quick answer, and the one which is easily understood, is that it is through emotions. Emotions are a key to understanding animal behavior. So what causes emotions? The particular emotions that an animal experiences, which is related to the formation of groups, is pleasure, simple pleasure, the pleasure of being close to another individual. And this can be seen in stock animals in fields and ranches where you can see them browsing or grazing close to each other. Why do they do this? They do this because they express pleasure at their interaction with being with each other. And the very word pleasure basically negates the whole necessity for kin selection. Now, what causes pleasure? Well, hormones do. Hormones cause many different feelings of animals, one among which is pleasure. There are many others, fear, and many others, but the one which we're concerned with is the pleasure of association. So what hormones are involved in this, in the introduction? Production of pleasure. Well, I'm not going to answer that directly, at least not yet. What I'm going to do is to give you some examples, and then you can see how the basic principles work. Let's consider first human children. Human children are intensely gregarious. They love to play with each other. It's the joy of their lives. And they form their associations with many different individuals. They form them with family members. They form them with neighbors. They form them from school, from being at the same school. They form them in the playground. They form them in the sporting activities. There's one particular facet of human-child interaction which is of considerable importance. It's not an absolute, but it is a general principle, and that is that simply boys like to play with boys and with boys' toys. Girls like to play with girls and with girls' toys. And when they mature, they switch their allegiances. Again, not absolutely, but boys and girls tend to associate with each other. Now, what hormones are involved in this? The one which is most obvious are the sex. What controls the hormones? Are the sex hormones? Testosterone and estradiol. So we see here that the sex hormones are involved in this transition to opposite sex attraction. Let's take another example. Animals that breed just once a year. There are a large number of them. I want to consider basically the large herb, grass-eating or leaf-eating mammals, which we are all familiar with, like deer and sheep and buffalo and what have you. They breed usually in the autumn in order to give birth to the young in the spring. They, shortly before the breeding season begins, the males become pretty antsy, and they engage in jousts to determine which is the strongest. The ones that win the jousts are the ones that breed. The other ones have little chance of coming near to the females. The females don't play an active role in this. So the males enjoy, all the males then, join to the females at the mating season. When it is over, the males go away. The females retain that standing, and the males leave. But they don't leave alone. They leave as a group, and they form what's known as a bachelor group. What is associated with this? Well, again, we can draw a correlation. The testosterone of the male declines to an almost into nothing at the end of the mating season, and it remains that way until next season approaches. So here we have a potential correlation between the disappearance of opposite sex attraction and the appearance of same-sex attraction. What about the females? Well, the females are not active. They're subordinate in during the rut. So they don't need to experience much change of estrogen, and they don't. On the other hand, just before giving birth, estrogen rises dramatically, and shortly after birth, it declines dramatically. Now, we can understand this by analogy with what I've gone before as a potential explanation. The rise in the estrogen level will cause a loosening, or can be expected to cause a loosening of the attachment of these mothers to the rest of the flock. And in actual practice, they leave the flock to hide so they can give birth to undercover and alone. And this has two benefits. Firstly, they're less in danger of predators. And secondly, the mother and infant can bond with each other. When the estrogen returns to normal, they rejoin the flock. So that's a second example. The third example is, which I'll give, and is that there are lots of other ones which I could give, is the emperor penguin. The emperor penguin lives its whole life in the oceans adjacent to Antarctica or on the ice. They breed in the early winter, but the breeding site is far from the ocean, so that both genders leave the ocean and onto the ice and waddle towards the mating site, which can be over 100 kilometers from the sea. The sex hormones of both genders are modest when they leave the ocean, but they rise to a peak when they reach the mating site. Both testosterone and estradiol do. The birds mate, they have single partners. A few weeks later, the female lays her egg. Now, by this time, the sex steroids have dropped dramatically, and the females leave as a group. They leave to go back to the sea to recuperate from the cost of laying the egg. They have passed the egg to the male, and the males stay on this site in the adjacent to the mainland and form a cluster which is so close that there is basically no separation between the birds of this huge colony. And it is this way that they survive until the chicks are hatched in the very early spring. So we have three examples of ways in which hormones can interact with animals to further their goals. I want to consider now a further method of interaction, which is that some species, and notably that's humans, are able to breed at any time of the year. And there are other ones. I mean, it applies to other primates, to hyenas and other animals. So now there's a problem here. And that is that if they can breed at any time of the year, then they have to, and they do, retain their masculinity of desire throughout this period, which leaves the question, can they be social? And the answer in humans is, of course, yes, they can. There's no question about that. So how does this take place? For this, one needs to examine what happens in the fetus. Fairly early in fetal development, the Y chromosome of the male causes the production of testosterone. And this testosterone specifies that the sex of the fetus will be male. On the other hand, the absence of that hormone, the absence of testosterone, specifies that the sex organs of the fetus will be female. And this is absolute. There are very rare exceptions which arise from deleterious traits, but they are very rare. Pretty much all sex, physical sex, is specific at this stage. Now, another wave of hormones takes place much later in pregnancy. Leading up to and just beyond the birth of the infant. And this is a period during which brain development is taking place at a great rate. This is controlled not by testosterone, but by estrogen. But it doesn't actually make any difference. A high level of estrogen specifies a male desires. That is attraction to females when they grow up. The absence of estradiol specifies female sexual preferences. But this division between male and female is much more ambiguous than that of the formation of the gonads. It is quite clear from studies that some intermediate levels of the hormone are associated in establishing gender preference. And so this can give rise to quite considerable variations in animal or human behavior. Mm. And this leads us to consider homosexuality. Homosexuality is a fairly common trait. It occurs in about 5% of males and a somewhat lower level of females. It has a genetic component. In fact, it is largely genetic in its basis. That has been established by comparing identical twins. It is found in all cultures, in all societies. It seems to have been stable, as far as we can tell, over periods of millennia. And this, in general, it causes a deficit in reproduction. So gay individuals reproduce at about a fifth the rate of straight individuals. Now, this is problematic because you would have thought that this would give rise to the diminution or disappearance of the trait itself, because it is not reproductive. But that doesn't happen. So now, why doesn't it happen? Well, let's consider an idea which has been proposed called sexually selective antagonism. Now, the idea behind sexually selective antagonism is that a trait may be beneficial in one gender and deleterious in another. And so let's give a potential example of this. Consider a highly feminine female. She is likely to marry at a younger age and to have a larger family. So that's beneficial. But what about her offspring? Some of those offspring will, of course, be male, and some of those male offspring may be gay, and so therefore relatively non-productive. Now, studies have been done on this, which show that pretty much precisely the increased family size of these females is matched by or matches the decline in productivity of male owls. So that could potentially resolve the problem. But it really doesn't, because you have to ask the question, why doesn't sexual desire become as specific and complete as happens with the development of the sex organs? And in order to understand that, we need to understand a little bit more about the nature of homosexuality. The famous reports of Alfred Kinsey of the 1940s established the conditions in which homosexuality, both gay and lesbian, existed in the population. And Kinsey divided the homosexual intensity into six different categories. Number one would be where a single homosexual encounter occurred. And then it rose to number six, which is completely unambiguous homosexuality. So in other words, homosexuality is not a simple one-stage trait. It is, in fact, a great range of traits. So this gives rise to the idea that to the idea that So this gives rise to the idea that all individuals have some degree of masculine and feminine propensities, and that these propensities are biased. They're biased towards masculinity in males and biased towards femininity in females, but nevertheless not absolute. And this now gives space for sociality, because if sociality is not necessarily confined, but is associated with same-sex interaction, same-sex, friendships, then that allows human sociality to play a role. Now, human sociality is hugely important. We gain pleasure, not sexual pleasure, but social pleasure, from associating with people, and they may not even have to be the same gender, but generally are, but between people who engage in all kinds of endeavors, who simply enjoy the company of others in pubs, in sports, and all kinds of things, and that's particularly in cooperation in producing products. And without this cooperation, we could not be a civilization. We could not be separate from other species. Now, this has been a study has been performed recently, which has just come out, or at least is being publicized, to determine the pedigree of homosexuality. The question that was asked is basically, where is the gay gene? And they used a huge number of volunteers to establish the pedigree. 25,000 homosexuals and about nearly 500,000 straight people were involved in the study. And they did not succeed. They were not able to show that there was any specific gene. There doesn't have to be a specific gene. There is certainly a huge genetic component, but let's just compare homosexuality with, say, the heights of individuals. Heights of adults, males vary between about 7 feet and 5 feet, but it's a continuum, just as the homosexuality is a continuum. It's clearly got genetic origins, but nevertheless, various factors impose to determine adult height. So this is an analogy, I think a good analogy, with homosexuality. So now let's consider a few other things which are related to the hypothesis of hormonal control. One of these is that it opens the door
Mr. Caswell, just so you know, we're at the one-minute mark. We are at the one-minute mark of the interview.
Okay, well, why don't I stop?
It's just so engaging. I'm just curious if you could give the last few words for our listeners.
Well, okay, let me have one last word, and that is familiarity. It allows for an enhanced effect of familiarity, which is also a trait exhibited by both animals and humans. Now I've finished.
It's so fascinating. What I love about this book is just how much it's so rigorous and so well researched, and yet also just as a human being, it's very enlivening to understand that our sociality is so essential to our makeup and to other animals. It's been such a pleasure having you on, and I can't recommend more to our readers to pick up a copy of your book. But it has been wonderful speaking with you, Mr. Caswell, and I hope you have a wonderful rest of your day.
Can I add something? I would surely wish that it would go into the libraries of high schools and colleges, and would be read by teachers of biology.
Yes, no. I mean, it seems like such essential reading on just a basic level is something that we all need to understand. And yes, no, I hope that it's picked up by those who are educating and can spread these lessons to everybody.
Thanks.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much. And I hope to speak to you again. And, you know, you have so much to offer all of us. So I really appreciate you writing this book and you speaking with us today.
Well, I appreciate the opportunity to talk about it.
Wonderful. Wonderful. Thank you. All right. Well, have a wonderful day. And I'll make sure that our readers pick up a copy. I can't recommend it enough to them.
Great. Thanks a lot.
Take care.
Bye.
That was author Anthony Caswell discussing his book, The Social Gene. This has been AMI Radio with your host, Charles Green. And as always, remember to read on.